necessarily in the room to express an opinion. I was there to follow up on whatever was decided in the meeting and get stuff done. But I shared my views anyway. There was no pressure. I wasn't expected to have the answers. And my words didn't carry the weight of consequence. If anyone was going to act on my suggestion, it was on them. But I understood I had the power to be heard. Another friend and mentor, Evelyn Lieberman, gave me that power. At the time she gave me this advice, she was a deputy press secretary for President Clinton. She eventually became the deputy chief of staff, along with Harold Ickes, under Leon Panetta, two more mentors. Evelyn, who passed away in 2016, was a remarkable force of nature. She commanded so much respect that all of us, including Leon and Harold, called her Mrs. Lieberman. Everything was her business. Her opinion mattered in any forum where she chose to share it. Her advice to me was simply, people take their cue from you. That's it. If you act like you belong in the room, people will believe you do. If you act like your opinion matters, others will too. Simple, true, empowering, and life-changing advice. It is applicable for all women in every endeavor we undertake. On my second go-around serving in the White House, I was a senior staff person. I ran a department. When I weighed in, my words weren't just heard, but had consequences. Having a position of power should make you feel more comfortable expressing your view. And yet I found it was harder for me, and I think it was harder for some other women too. That's when you have to get over your inhibitions and rise to the challenge to do the job you were hired to do. You can't think of it as reaching the next rung on the ladder of female empowerment. It's simply a matter of doing your job. Granted, when your job is to advise the President of the United States on how our country should handle an issue for which there are only bad choices, it can be scary as hell. It can seem safer to pull back and say nothing. To overcome self-doubt in these situations, I finally landed on an accommodation that helped me get over myself, and I think it can help other women too. Instead of mentally running through all the people who could be better than me at the job, I decided to accept that there are a lot of talented people in my field and that some of them are probably better than me. If they held a nationwide search to find someone to be the White House communications director, they could probably find somebody better than me, I allowed myself to conclude. But not that much better. And I'm the one who's in the room now, and I'm here for a reason, to do a job. Moreover, even though it's my job to speak up, and I shouldn't consider every word that comes out of my mouth as striking a blow for female empowerment, I do owe a debt of gratitude to all the women who fought for my right to be in this room. So I'll be damned if I don't make the most of it while I'm here. Madam President, when you gain entry to the Oval Office, I hope you take that same attitude with you. I also hope you are thoughtful about choosing the voices that surround you. The people in your Oval Office should look like the entire country you represent, not just one ethnicity or gender. Every decision you make will be better because of it. And make sure each of them speaks up. They are in the room, and they are there for a reason, and their voices are essential. Chapter 4. Nod less, cry more. It's your world, and you can cry if you want to. It's election night around 10 p.m. I am in the small suite on the 10th floor of the peninsula that has been set up as workspace for the staff. My colleague, Huma Abedin, has sat down next to me to ask about the latest returns. What are you saying? I am saying that there's a very good chance Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States. Huma nods. I recognize it. It is the same nod I gave when Robbie Mook, our campaign manager, called me at Hillary's hotel the night of the Iowa caucus, which we were predicted to win by as many as 6 points, to say he thought we would win, but it would be really, 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 really close, and maybe I should come over to headquarters. The same nod Hillary gave 10 days earlier on the plane in Cedar Rapids when I broke the news that Comey had reopened the email investigation. The same nod I gave when Robbie pulled me aside just 2 hours earlier at the peninsula to say something was off in a few of the states. Well, something was off in almost all of the states. Huma nods, the way we have throughout the campaign as we absorbed more bad news, processed another mountain we would have to climb. We are 22 points down in New Hampshire. We will lose the Wisconsin primary by 20 points. Her FBI interview will be on July 2nd. There's a really awful video of Trump from Access Hollywood. WikiLeaks just dumped a bunch of Podesta's emails. It looks like the transcripts of Hillary's Wall Street speeches are out there. I register Huma's reaction to the news that we are likely to lose. Her stoicism is remarkable, but not surprising. Huma nods because it is all she or I know on this campaign. We never permitted ourselves any other kind of reaction to bad news. You don't blanch, you don't panic, you show no emotion. I can handle this. I can handle anything. Men may nod stoically at bad news, too. It's where the practice started, after all. But it is required of the women. People, men and women alike, will watch for your reaction to bad news. Can she handle this? Is she tough enough? There's something else in the nod from a woman, an acquiescence, a need for approval. If this is the hoop, I will jump through it. If I don't nod, if I somehow object, say this is all too hard, then I am not ready for this. And I am ready for anything. It's how successful women in all walks of life, whether they are leading a small family or a large company, behave. That's how I have operated my whole career, and I was proud of it. No one was tougher than me. I thought it worked great until dehydration and exhaustion landed me in the hospital one day in late August 2016. Hillary emailed me as soon as she heard, and I emailed her back and explained what had happened. She responded with an all-caps screed any 12-year-old girl would be proud to call her own. OMG, where are you? What can I do to help? Please do whatever the doctors tell you to do. Your health is too important. They sent me home later that night. I slept for 4 days and then went back out on the trail. Then, a week later, Hillary came down with pneumonia. I forwarded her the screed she sent me and told her to take her own advice. She didn't. I didn't. Like most women. We nod the next time we get some bad news and keep going. Every woman reading this knows what I am talking about. This nodding is one of the ways women have adapted our behavior to succeed in a man's world. For me and a lot of other women I know, it's a toxic brew of the need to prove we are tough enough to play a man's game, combined with a woman's sense of duty. We all feel the need to be a superwoman, which in my experience means being all that society has traditionally expected of women, with what we aspire to do added onto the side. Men spent centuries building the professional world, devising rules to make sure it was a comfortable place for them and that it was geared toward their particular qualities and skills. Like any good guest, women have looked for clues on how we are to behave in this foreign land. We have tried to understand and follow the local customs. We have intuited that in this world, we are to be obliging, calm under pressure, and diligent, and to always keep our emotions in check. Our adaptive skills have served many of us well, but we aren't in a man's world anymore. Now it's our world. And shame on us women if we don't do something to change the way this game is played so that everybody is able to bring their best to the effort. Let's embrace a new way of working that is equally geared toward our own qualities and skills. What would have happened if at some point in the Clinton campaign, I hadn't nodded and absorbed the latest blow, but objected? If I'd said, that's crazy, we can't let this happen, or that's crazy, we can't survive that. Sadly, I have no idea, which is why we have to change. We have no idea what beneficial qualities we might be stifling in ourselves as long as we continue to follow an outdated set of behavioral rules that were designed to permit women to play a niche role in a workplace built for men. Madam President, I have a suggestion for two new guidelines all women can adopt in the workplace to make it better suited to our qualities. Let's nod less and cry more. Crying at work? It's long been considered a workplace sin for women, right? No more. Imagine what would happen if we all showed up to work one day and started bawling. The ultimate female power play. Crying isn't a show of weakness. It's a powerful demonstration of emotion. It's not something you should do constantly, but I don't see the need to fight to hold the tears in the way we do. For women, and at least some men, crying can be a way we express anger, or frustration or passion or sadness. We shouldn't mute all of that. I am a pretty big crier. I'm not someone who will sob at work, but I am easily moved to tears when talking about something or someone I care about. Most of the time, my eyes will mist and just shine with tears, but no tears fall. If the press was writing about it, I think they would describe it as being visibly moved. Sometimes, if it is something I really care about, my eyes will shine and my voice will crack too. That's what happened at Harvard. The Harvard postmortem is an event built into the campaign process that gives every defeated campaign the opportunity to be gracious losers. Officials from the winning and losing campaigns come together at Harvard for 2 days of questioning from the press. Harvard records and transcribes all the sessions to be published in a book they dub the first draft of history of the campaign. I understood that the thing you are supposed to do when you lose a presidential election is accept defeat gracefully for the good of your candidate and for the good of your country. You're supposed to take ownership, explain what mistakes you made, and stop criticizing the winner. This is particularly expected of the female staff of the losing campaign. Except I hadn't expected to lose, and I wasn't sure this was a year when you were supposed to be gracious about it. I had signed up to go to Harvard earlier in the fall when I thought we would win, but my colleagues had to convince me to go after our loss. Not because I can't be a gracious loser in theory, I just couldn't see being gracious to this particular team given the way they had beaten us. I was eventually convinced that we needed to go to defend Hillary, otherwise the press and Trump's team would pummel her, as if losing weren't punishment enough. Trump was a phenomenon I had never seen before, a president riding into office on a strategy dependent on dividing the country to succeed. In the days preceding the forum, I pictured myself summoning just the right combination of words for this first draft of history that would make clear that the 2016 election was something different. I wanted everyone there to know I would rather lose than win the way Trump did, and that I wasn't embarrassed to have been on the losing side. That as time went on, I would be proud to have been part of the effort to stop Trump. That's what I imagined I would say. But I knew that I would have to forego most of what I had composed in my imaginary diatribe. However, I did promise myself at least one moment where I would call out the Trump campaign on race. I didn't know what to expect from the Trump side. I thought there was a chance that the Trump team, for the sake of their own reputations, would decide to behave like gracious winners. That's not what happened. They gloated. They taunted us for 2.5 hours. At first, I sat there glum and relatively mute. We were the losers after all, and I was waiting for the right question or opening that would give me my opportunity to say my piece. The moment came when Dan Balls of the Washington Post asked us how it felt in both campaigns when Steve Bannon was hired to be the CEO of the Trump campaign. My colleague Karen Finney started in first, calling the Trump campaign out on their race baiting. Exasperated, frustrated, and angry, I joined in. All of the imaginary conversation, both what I'd intended to keep in my head and what I thought needed to be said, came flying out of my mouth. And I did not deliver it with just the right combination of words or with the calm, steely resolve I had imagined myself possessing when the moment came. Nope. It was all said through misty eyes with my voice shaking. I was emotional. I really cared about the words I had to say, and they moved me to tears. After my outburst, the rest of the panel was a blur. I left the room in a hurry with Robbie to help him get ready for his own one-on-one televised session with Kellyanne Conway. Then, on my flight out of Logan, there were a number of reporters. One of them called out to me, pointing at her phone and waving her arms. I got it. The story was blowing up. The Harvard postmortem isn't normally a big news event, but this year was to be different. I landed in D.C. and my phone buzzed with texts and stories the news outlets had written up on the exchange. It was officially a thing. The Washington Post described it as a shouting match. We were not shouting, I thought, in irritation. The Post also said I choked up. I put down the phone and drove home. My husband was watching Brian Williams on MSNBC, and they were playing audio of the panel. Audio? There's audio of this thing? Who knew? I listened and winced. Yep, We were shouting, and I did indeed choke up. My voice was shaking. Three strikes against me. I showed none of the grace losers are supposed to. I accused my opponents of stoking racism, and I cried while I did it. This was going to leave a mark. I couldn't care that night and went to sleep. A few days later, I had a meeting with an acquaintance in D.C. "I saw what happened," he said to me. "That kind of thing isn't good for anyone. I guess it was too soon for you." "It wasn't too soon," I said. "I don't regret it." I was glad I said it. The tears were distracting for some people, but I was angry and emotional, and it all made me want to cry. That couldn't be helped. I couldn't get through it without crying. Think of all the times you have heard someone say they passed on sharing something that was particularly moving because they didn't think they could get it out without crying. That's a shame. Think of all the incredible things we didn't get to hear because someone was scared we would see them cry. In the aftermath of the Harvard event, I was glad to find out that it didn't matter to me. I spoke the truth about something I really cared about. It was worthwhile. In the Clinton White House press office, my office was referred to as the crying room. The press staff endured many stressful days together. People were always welcome to come cry in my office when they needed to let out some of the stress. At least once a day, someone was in there crying. Usually it was a woman, not always. Men cried in there too. Sometimes they would want me to hear them out. Sometimes they wanted to be left alone to cry. No one I worked with, man or woman, thought anything of it other than that it was a human reaction to the inhumane crush a president and his or her staff endure. No stigma was attached to anyone who had to use the crying room. I certainly used it myself many times. A woman can be both strong and emotional. I am. I am someone who cries when I am moved or frustrated, and I am great in a crisis. I hope you will see fit to let us see some of your tears, as other presidents have done in recent years. It'll be more loaded when our first woman president cries. I don't discount that. But the American public that elects you will already know you are strong. So if you sometimes tear up in public, it may help normalize the practice and may make other women less reluctant to cry in the workplace. And make sure your White House has a crying room. It's our world, and we should be able to cry in it if we want to. Chapter 5. Keep your head and your heart during a storm. You need both to steer the ship to safety. Madam President, in the course of my career, I have ridden out more than my share of political storms. I was there for Whitewater, the Clinton impeachment, John Edwards' trial, the healthcare.gov website crash, the Ebola epidemic, Hillary's emails, Russian hacks and leaks, multiple natural disasters, and foreign policy crises like the Kosovo War and ISIS beheadings. It's pretty fair to say that I have seen it all, and it is certain that you will encounter many more crises in the Oval Office. No, they can have a very destabilizing effect on the White House if you failed to lead properly. You're going to need to keep both a cool head and a warm heart to steer your ship through the storm. Everyone gets the keeping a cool head part of the equation. You have to lead by example and keep your team calm and focused in a crisis. I have learned from watching President Obama and Hillary Clinton that the best leaders also listen with their hearts in times of crisis. They make sure the people serving them have the moral support they need to get the job done, and they make sure the people they serve are getting the leadership they need, too. It was October 2013. I was the White House Communications Director and responsible for press around the launch of healthcare.gov, the website to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. It wasn't going well. The website did not work, and there was devastating wall-to-wall press coverage of the failure. I saw it as my responsibility to fix it. On one level, it was kind of a silly crisis. Our national security wasn't threatened, nor did we face any real health threat, as we did the following fall with the Ebola outbreak. It was simply a website that did not work, but eventually would get fixed. Nevertheless, the failure presented a very serious risk to us. The press coverage was relentless and was doing real damage every day to President Obama's standing, the credibility of the healthcare program, and people's belief in the ability of government to tackle big problems. There was a lot on the line, and I felt enormous pressure to do something to stem the tide of terrible press. My colleague Tara McGinnis and I spent a lot of time and effort trying to come up with ways to improve the news coverage. We searched for the few people who had gotten the website to work and have them tell their stories. I worked to draw attention to other important work that was happening in the Obama administration. None of it helped. I was searching for a moment that would count as a turning point in the crisis that would successfully move the press off of covering the website and onto other issues. It eluded me. The team working on healthcare held daily meetings with President Obama to update him on our progress. At the end of each meeting, Tara and I would tell him our latest plans to try to improve the press around the website. After one meeting, as we got up to leave, the president told Tara and me to stay back. He told us, "I want you to know that the press isn't going to get better until the site actually works." He went on to say, "It's great that you were trying and you should keep at it, but I just want you to know that I know this story isn't going away till we get the website working." I was grateful that he saw the situation clearly and knew it was not possible for us to generate better press under the current circumstances, and that he had the heart to know that Tara and I needed to hear that from him. It relieved a lot of the stress I had been feeling and gave me the ability to look more clearly at the situation and come up with a realistic plan for how to manage press while the website was being fixed. We did that by establishing a credible timeline for when the site would be repaired. We would do periodic press calls to update the media on the progress we were making. We set up press visits to the headquarters where the work was being done so there was something for the cameras to film. The team fixing the site hit their marks. We started to regain a bit of credibility, and 2 months later, the site worked. The press moved on to other matters. It was July 2013. The verdict in the Trayvon Martin murder case had recently been handed down, and there was tremendous pain and outrage in the African-American community over the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the vigilante who had shot and killed the unarmed teenage boy. It was clear that the president's voice was going to be needed to help calm this storm. At the staff level, we had been discussing what he should say in response to the verdict. I thought he needed to talk to the African-American community and was working through different options that would be most suitable. We were looking at an African-American radio show, or maybe a visit to a local boys' club so the president could visit with some black teenage boys and let them know they were loved and valued. The president called me, Valerie Jarrett, and our press secretary, Jay Kearney, down to the Oval Office to discuss. When we got there, I asked him if he thought the African-American community needed to hear from him. "No," he said, "I think I need to speak for them." He then laid out what he thought needed to be said. He said 35 years ago, he could have easily been Trayvon, a 17-year-old black boy whose life was cut short because someone was unnerved by the color of his skin. He spoke of experiences he had in his own life of white women crossing the street to avoid him at night or security guards following him around stores to make sure he didn't shoplift. He talked about how he and Mrs. Obama knew if they had sons instead of daughters, they would have had to have the talk with their sons about going out of their way to steer clear of trouble with the police. The president was sitting in his customary yellow chair on the right side of the fireplace. I sat on the couch facing him and listened as our first black president told us about his own personal journey with racism. Behind his head was a bust of Martin Luther King and a framed copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. Like any job, working in the West Wing can feel like a grind. You faced an endless stream of crises for which there were no easy solutions, just an unappealing set of bad options from which you sought to make the right choice. Press and political criticism were unending. It could all wear you down. But then there were moments like this one when you know you're witnessing history. I felt profoundly grateful to be in this room and hear him share these stories. I knew I was witnessing history. The next day, the president went to the White House press briefing room and shared with all of the country what he had told us privately the day before about what it is like to live as a black man in America. It was a remarkable moment. No pollster would have advised him to make a speech like that, but it was something all of the country needed to hear. He had listened with his heart and understood what the people of this country, black and white, needed from their president at that moment. Hillary has had more than her share of storms to weather. A big one came her way on October 28th, 2016, when the news broke that the FBI was reopening the Clinton email investigation. We were flying to Iowa when we learned of the news. Robbie, Nick, and I approached Hillary on the plane, preparing to tell her of the shocking development. "I have something to tell you," I said to her. "Okay," she said cheerfully. "What do you have to tell me?" "It's bad," I replied. "Really bad." "Okay," she said, turning serious and folding her hands to brace herself for what was coming. After I told her the news, she nodded and then got the slightest wry smile on her face. "You knew we weren't done, didn't you?" I asked. "Yes, I knew we weren't done," she responded. She knew we weren't going to make it all the way to Election Day without a major new plot twist, and here it was. "All right," she said matter-of-factly, "let's talk about what we're going to do about it." We discussed putting out a staff-level statement first and decided she would speak publicly to the matter later in the day after we learned more. This was the worst kind of crisis, the kind in which you have no means of even knowing what you're dealing with. It's not as if the FBI contacted the campaign to explain what was happening. The only information we had was what we heard from the media and what was in the Comey letter. We were flying blind. The FBI had decided, for whatever reason, to reopen the email investigation. That wasn't a problem we could solve. All we could do was figure out how to address the sudden reappearance of the elephant in the room in such a way that we could then quickly move the press away from that subject and onto issues people cared about. We decided the best course of action was to call on the FBI to tell the public the full details of what it was examining and express our concern about the timing of such a momentous action this close to an election. We did this in a written statement from the campaign and then as part of a press conference by Hillary. She showed remarkable composure at that press conference and over the course of the next 11 days as we sought to ride out this storm. Behind the scenes, beyond her composure, Hillary showed remarkable heart. By the end of that day in Iowa, we understood that the FBI's new actions on emails were actually related to the case it was pursuing against Huma Abedin's then-husband, Anthony Weiner. It was wrenching to watch the pain this news caused Huma. She was distraught. Hillary and I sat with her in our cabin on the plane as Huma sobbed. "He is going to kill me," was all Huma could manage to say in between sobs. She had been through so much in her marriage and on the campaign and had always managed to stay focused on her job and wear a brave face through whatever crisis she was facing. This was a rare moment when she broke down. I watched as Hillary hugged her and was able to help calm Huma down. On the flight back to New York that night, Hillary insisted all of us have big ice cream sundaes in an effort to cheer Huma up. She never said a word of complaint over the course of the next 11 days about the impact the Comey letter was having on her personally. From the moment I came to her with the bad news to Election Day, she maintained an upbeat attitude and kept all of us focused on what we needed to get done. She was a real trooper and used all of her head and heart to steer us. Looking back, I see that we on the staff should have listened more to what Hillary's heart was telling her during this time. On the staff side, we were watching polls to try to judge how people were taking in the news of the Comey letter. Hillary was listening with her heart, and what it told her was at odds with what her team was advising. While emails were quite literally the last topic we wanted voters to hear Hillary Clinton talk about barely a week before the election, we initially all agreed she needed to address the issue in her campaign speeches for the first couple of days after the story broke. We knew people would be hearing about emails in the press and wanted to have them hear our side of the story. But after a couple of days, I was convinced it was time for us to move on to other topics. The rest of the campaign team was eager to get back to talking about issues people care about. And I agreed that we had already said the little bit we were able to say about the FBI and should not continue to give the press footage of Hillary talking about emails. So we stopped addressing it. Unfortunately, the story stuck around and continued to dominate news coverage of the campaign. Every day, Hillary would ask if we were all sure she shouldn't be talking about the FBI and emails in her remarks. She was uneasy about not addressing it and leaving a vacuum for her opponents and others to fill, even though there was no polling evidence suggesting it was helpful for her to continue to talk about it. In retrospect, I see she was right. But we convinced her it was better for her not to raise the emails and instead to talk about issues that affected people's lives and problems she would solve as president. But no one was hearing her talk about the issues they cared about because they were still hearing about emails. Whether or not it would have helped, it was foolish on our part to not continue to proactively address the FBI matter. We should have understood that people would take their cue from the media and continue to care about the emails, and that our attempts to focus attention on anything else would be perceived as avoidance of a painful subject. It was a mistake, though at the time it was hard to accept that telling Hillary to keep bringing up the emails herself could possibly be the right advice. But I should have seen that, as unappealing as addressing the issue was, it was what voters needed to hear from Hillary at that moment. She got that. It is the same sense President Obama had that told him what the country needed to hear from him about race after the Trayvon Martin case. Madam President, you are certain to encounter many storms. That cannot be avoided. Listen to both your head and your heart when you are leading in a time of crisis. Keep a cool head and hear the advice of your counselors. Take in all the wisdom their expertise brings them. But also listen to what your heart tells you the people serving you and the people you serve need from you in this crisis. There are times it may be at odds with the advice you are getting. Trust most what your own heart and head tell you to do. They will help you steer the ship to safety. Chapter 6. Embrace Your Battle Scars. Show us what you have been through. It tells us what we can survive. All of our presidents age in office. It is practically a national pastime of ours to marvel at the toll the job takes on the face of our presidents. During President Obama's second term, I remember being stunned by photos of him from the 2008 campaign. So young. The Barack Obama from 2008 looked like he could be the son of the man who is president now. I know all this wear and tear on your face will pose a special challenge for you. You, more than all the men who preceded you, will be judged on your appearance and how attractive you are. I don't expect you will ever stop paying the pink tax, the additional hour or more required for hair and makeup. Those days are not behind us. No matter your age, you'll be judged on your face, weight, clothes, and hair. And no matter how lined your face is or isn't coming into this job, it will age with the job. It will acquire battle scars. I think your battle scars can be a comfort to the rest of us. They will show us what you have endured and tell us what we can survive. I hope you will let them show. I do. I want my own face to be attractive, but I also want it to tell you something about the life that I have lived. I have had a lot of experiences. I want something to show for them. The first time I noticed wrinkles forming between my eyebrows was during my years in the Clinton White House. And I was happy to see them. I thought the wrinkles told you I had lived through stressful times and gained some wisdom and maturity during them. Later, I remember seeing a brochure at a spa that told you how you could get rid of the 11s between your eyebrows. My 11s? I thought, these wrinkles have a name and I'm supposed to get rid of them? But they are so cool. I decided I was going to let my 11s show. They told a story about myself I wanted the world to see. I also want the joy and sadness I experienced on my 50th birthday to show on my face. My 50th birthday was 1 week after Election Day. I had figured out that there was supposed to be a surprise birthday party for me on Wednesday, November 9th. I had gotten emails from friends who missed the surprise part of the party invitation, and said either that they were excited to celebrate with me or were sorry they couldn't make it. I had not let on to Jim that I knew. On that Wednesday morning, I told him that I had figured out there was some sort of party and didn't think I could do it and wanted to cancel. I expected he might protest, but he agreed. It is Tuesday, November 15th. I've decided to spend my actual 50th birthday in Dana's hospice room at Silverado Turtle Creek Memory Care in Dallas. It is just me and Dana in the room. Beth and Lisa left a few hours ago after being there for a week. Misty is out running errands. Ingrid Moss, one of Dana's amazingly dedicated and knowledgeable home health caregivers, steps out so I can have time alone with Dana. It is a beautiful day in Dallas. We have the window open to let a slight warm breeze into the room. The autumn sun in Texas is something I delight in. It is just bold enough to leave you feeling warm inside and out. I had planned on leaving Dallas the day before, but decided I wanted to be with Dana on my actual birthday. I called Jim from Dana's room on Monday to tell him I was going to stay another day. To my great surprise, Dana hears and understands. Thank you. They were the only intelligible words she volunteered to me during my final days with her in Dallas. She can still, at times, respond to direct yes or no questions. But this thank you was something she initiated, a final gift to me. It soothes her to hear music. I put on May the Long Time Sun Shine Upon You, a favorite song of hers from practicing and teaching yoga. I play it over and over. Then I play music she and I loved together growing up. America. The first gift I remember buying Dana was History, America's Greatest Hits, for $5 at the Navy Exchange in Charleston, South Carolina, in 1977. We listened to it. I move on to Boz Scaggs' Silk Degrees, which we listened to a lot when all four sisters were living together in Dana's one-bedroom apartment in Benicia, California, for a few months in 1980. My dad had retired from the Navy in April and had started a new job in another town. So all four of us girls lived together while Beth and I finished the school year. And Lisa, back for the summer from Clemson, lifeguarded at a nearby pool. Poor Dana. She was 22 years old, just graduated from college, had her first real apartment on her own, and had to live there with her three little sisters. I know she had some low moments at the time, but the four of us laughed about it for 30 years after. Next, I put on Dan Fogelberg, Seals and Crofts, Carole King, Jackson Brown. Eventually, we end up in the modern day, and I play Sarah Bareilles' Brave. This has become Dana's anthem, and while she was still able to do so, she had sung it every morning. I sing it for her this time. I text Lisa to tell her what we've been doing. You were able to get through Brave, she asks. Me. Yes. It was sad, but good. And it was. There were many excruciatingly difficult moments in Dana's illness from Alzheimer's, but there was never a moment when we felt we had truly lost Dana. You could look in her eyes and see that behind the plaque that built up in her brain and prevented her from understanding and communicating, Dana was still there. I would tell her so. I would look her in the eye and say, I see you. I see you in there. Most times she would nod back. I could tell it was a comfort to her. In those moments, she was Dana refined, not reduced, but refined, to her most essential self. Time was suspended. It could be 2016. It could be 1976. We are sisters, holding hands and feeling the bonds that bind us together over decades, and just able to love each other. Those moments in her Dallas room were the most meaningful and joyful that I spent with her, that I've ever spent anywhere with anyone. I say my final goodbye to her and head to the Dallas airport. I decide to take a picture of myself to memorialize my 50th birthday and final day with Dana. There's a Shiner Bock in the foreground. You can see the two new important talismans I am wearing, a butterfly necklace my father gave the women in our family in Dana's honor, and the small loving-kindness medallion Hillary gave me on the last day of the campaign. In 1 week, I have faced the loss of the most important presidential campaign of my lifetime and saying goodbye to my big sister. You can see the wear and tear of the last year in the photo. There are laugh and sleep deficit lines around my eyes, smile and frown lines around my mouth. I am okay with them. I decided years ago that I didn't want all that I have lived and learned to be smoothed over. The moments I just spent with Dana are in those lines. What I hope they show to the world is that you can endure a loss like the one my family experience and find unexpected blessings, joy, and meaning along the way. I hope that is what shows in the slightly sad but warm smile on my face in that photograph. I have always found older women's faces to be a comfort to me. I look at them and imagine what the lines tell me about all they have lived through. They are our connection to a time most of us can't remember. When I was growing up in the 1970s and 80s, I remember being envious of women who could remember a time from decades before. I imagine that having that long of a memory gave a person ballast and depth. A person who had lived for many decades would know they could trust themselves to handle any situation. I'm glad to now be such a person who can remember back decades. Look at my face. It tells you that I was a child in the 1970s. I am your connection to that time. I can tell you the songs that were popular and how we dressed and what the country felt like in that moment. I hope my face, which doesn't just resemble Dana, but shows that I lived in the same time as her, is a comfort to my niece and nephews. I hope that society eases up on the pressure for each of us to look young. I am exhausted by the omnipresent, stifling pressure of now. I see and feel everywhere. Seeing an older face makes me feel more grounded. There is something before this moment. There will be something after. I want to see that in my president's face, too. Because it's not just the burden of the job I see in the weathered faces of our presidents. I see the love they have for this country, the same way parents carry the love and concern they have for their children in their faces. Embrace your battle scars. They will show us all what you have endured in your life and in this job. They will tell us what we too will be able to survive and how much care and worry you put into this job on our behalf. They will tell us that you have been looking out for us, that our dreams, our challenges, what we have lost and the times we are victorious all mean something to you. Chapter 7. Her Story. Don't search for your role in his story. Write your own. The future is female. The past was too. It's just that no one thought it was important enough to bother writing it all down. Women have been a vital part of America's history all along, but it's hard to find that presence recorded anywhere. The women who appear in our history books are but a handful, nor will you find us in the history of our nation's most important writings, our founding documents. The Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution were all written by men, white men, of course. Some women may have had their fingerprints, if not signatures, on these documents, as noted in Cokie Roberts' book, Founding Mothers. But imagine how those documents and the country founded upon them would have been different if women had had an equal say in what was in them. Now, multiply that out and consider all the state constitutions, laws, history books, novels, movies, and plays that have been written by men in our country. You could understand how a woman might get the idea her story doesn't matter in America. Hillary Clinton didn't think her life story was interesting. This is common for women candidates. I got my first hint of the complexities involved in telling her story when we set out to find a suitable place for Hillary to make her formal presidential campaign announcement. It was early on in the spring of 2015. We were meeting in Hillary's offices in Midtown Manhattan and reviewing the potential speech sites our advance team had identified. Of the options presented to us, I thought City College in New York City was the best choice. The diverse background of the students there spoke to the future, and I thought it was a good fit given Hillary's history of advocacy for schools and children. Plus, it had a glass atrium, which was symbolically appealing for a woman looking to break the glass ceiling. Hillary was skeptical. She told us that she thought she needed to go somewhere that had more of a connection to our country's history. I made a face at that comment because it puzzled me. I told her that she didn't need to do that. That sort of thing was for candidates who weren't already well known. For example, relative presidential newcomer Senator Marco Rubio, who is a son of Cuban refugees, chose to launch his campaign at Miami's Freedom Tower, where Cuban refugees were first processed after being welcomed into America. It was a smart and inspiring location for him. It was a good way to tell his story. I didn't think Hillary needed to do that. Wherever she announced would hopefully become historic because the first woman president had announced there. She still thought she should cloak herself in the history of other presidents so Americans would have a way to connect to her. This still did not make sense to me. Why do we need to connect her to history? Let's tell her story. That's when I learned that Hillary didn't think she had an interesting story to tell. She said that her husband had a story, and President Obama had a story, but she did not. She did not see anything remarkable in her story, no struggle to which Americans could relate. She grew up middle class and had a mother who had struggled and whose difficulties had inspired Hillary to take up children's causes, but Hillary herself didn't struggle. She was the first person in her family to go to college and then law school. Then she met Bill Clinton, and the rest is his story, or history, same thing. We all liked her husband's story when we first heard it in 1992. He was from a place called Hope and born into a life of struggle. He lost his father before he was even born. He was young and smart, worked hard, pulled himself up by his bootstraps, and rose from small-town America to become president of the United States. That's a story we recognize as part of the American story. We like that. We want the lives of our presidents to reflect the classic elements of the American dream. President Obama's story was more of a reach for many of us, but we still found something of ourselves that we valued in it. The life story of an African-American man named Barack Hussein Obama wasn't one we immediately recognized as part of our own, but he told and represented a story about America we wanted to hear. He told us we weren't red states or blue states, we were the United States. He was going to bring us hope and change, and his election as our first black president represented the fulfillment of a promise of equality in America. President Barack Obama was an Only in America story, and it made us proud. But the first woman president, it wasn't part of the American story. All our leaders had been men. Our history, the canon of American stories we treasured and told us who we were all based on men. Hillary didn't fit the narrative. I thought about what Hillary said of her own life and had to admit she had a point. I'm embarrassed to say it now, but when I considered her life story at the time of the campaign, I didn't find it compelling. I didn't see anything remarkable in her upbringing. She had endured struggles as an adult, but they weren't the kind of struggles everyday Americans identified with. Worse, we saw them as distracting. It's not enough for your life to be hard. It has to make sense to us. We have to recognize the struggle. It has to tell us a larger story we want told about America. It didn't work with her story. There wasn't anything in our history to compare it to Hillary. I guess that's what happens to the people who are making history. We don't appreciate their value in real time. We ended up at FDR's Four Freedoms Park for the official announcement. Hillary was happy with it because it positioned her as part of a lineage of Democratic presidents who sought to solve big problems in our country. That was appropriate for her. It was what she wanted to do as president, even if it wasn't her story. But whatever a woman's story might be, it's hard for her to tell it when her voice isn't heard. It is also hard for her story to be told when people are too busy disliking the sound of her voice to listen to what she is saying. I ran into these problems with Hillary, too. Throughout the campaign, I was bombarded with advice from well-meaning folks who had recommendations for how Hillary could improve her speaking style. It was all contradictory. At first, I thought it was me and that I wasn't understanding the recommendations. But after a while, I realized that they just didn't make sense. In one memo, a person would argue that she needed to project strength but couldn't be shrill, couldn't ever shout but needed to show passion, couldn't ever look weak, but should show more vulnerability. The main advice in each memo was for her to be authentic. I complained to Hillary one day about how frustrating all of it was. She came up with the best response to this kind of advice. Tell them, she said, that you really appreciate the advice, but what would really help Hillary is if they could tell you the name of a woman on the world stage who does it exactly right. No one could ever produce a name. Of course. When it comes to pleasing the masses in a patriarchal society, women seeking power can't win playing by the old man-centric rules. This is why we should stop expecting to find ourselves reflected in our country's history and models of power and write our own story. That's what Hillary decided to do when she wrote her book, What Happened. It's not what losers normally do. I will admit to having been one of the hand-wringers who worried this would end badly for her. Whenever she has set out to explain herself in the past, whatever she had to say has been processed through some weird reverb and ended up distorted. This time, something different happened. This time, she was heard. For sure, there were those who criticized her, particularly right after the book came out, and a lot of people who just seemed to want her to go away. But she didn't care. She knew that was going to happen when she wrote the book. She kept going, and eventually her story was heard. In the end, much of the press ended up applauding her candor during her book tour. Predictably, there were a lot of people who lamented that if only we could have seen this Hillary during the campaign, things would have turned out different. That's all bullshit. She was always the same person. We are the ones who perceive her differently in different situations. We now see her story as interesting. Her book will be valuable to you, too, because the struggles Hillary lived through are no longer just her story. They are now part of America's history. They are part of our story. And when you undertake your presidential run, your story will be something we recognize, something familiar. And here I am, writing my story in hopes that my words can make a difference for you. After the campaign ended, I thought about writing a book. I wondered if my story would be interesting only where it intersected with someone else's interesting life, or if I had something of value to say on my own. After a couple of discouraging calls where I was told that unless I had something juicy to share about Hillary, there wouldn't be interest in me, I gave up. By the way, there aren't juicy things to share about Hillary because she's a simple and serious person. I also learned that John Heilman and Mark Halperin were going to do a third Game Change book. The original Game Change was written about the 2008 campaign and had been hugely successful. They had followed it up with one about the 2012 campaign and now planned a third about the highly dramatic last 45 days of the 2016 campaign. A frustrating fact of the campaign staffer's life is that the campaign books that usually sell the best and are given the most credence are the books written by the people who weren't there, the press. I suppose it's not entirely fair to say that the press weren't there. They did cover the campaign, but covering it isn't the same as being in it. I personally never found an instance in which the Game Change authors wrote something that was false, but that's different from writing the truth. To be able to write the truth, you have to have been there. John Heilman got in touch in the spring of 2017 to ask if I would participate. I equivocated. Even though I had given up the idea of writing a book, it still didn't sit right with me that someone else would tell our story. After a few weeks, I decided I would cooperate with them. I knew it would be a successful book, had an HBO movie deal attached to it, and would be treated as the definitive account of the campaign. When they wrote the original Game Change in 2008, I didn't participate, and Elizabeth Edwards got pretty well beaten up as a consequence. I didn't want the same thing to happen to Hillary. If the book was going to matter, I wanted to make sure it was true. I told John I was ready to talk with him and started a series of meetings with him in the late spring. Our last meeting was in October, shortly before their book deal blew up over Mark Halperin's past behavior of sexual harassment. In that October meeting, John told me I had spent a total of 17 hours with him, and sometimes him and Mark answering questions. Each of those hours was exhausting. The periods I sat with him didn't feel like interviews. They felt like sessions. They were emotional and draining. It was 2 to 3 hours of answering questions about something I no longer had any ability to do anything about. It wasn't necessarily John's fault. It was just an awful process. I always left feeling depleted and powerless. Then one day I realized I was not powerless. I shut out other voices from my head and forced myself to acknowledge that, regardless of what anyone else may think, I believed I had a powerful story to tell. And I was going to figure out how to tell it. And so I have told my story to help you and every woman who knows she can lead, but is uncertain about how to use her voice. 2017 was a watershed year for women telling their own stories as victims of sexual assault and harassment. It was nothing less than a revolution. Their accounts are unflinching, powerful, and most important, told in their own voices. To those who ask why they waited so long to tell their stories, I say the real question is, what gave them the courage to tell their stories even now? Each of these women had more to risk than to gain by telling her story, and did so anyway. Each of them saw a reason to believe her words could make a difference, and they have. Merely through the power of their words, these women have laid bare the true extent of sexually inappropriate male behavior in our culture, which in turn is forcing a zero-tolerance approach to the problem. These women are writing a brand new chapter in American history and radically changing the balance of power in the workplace, simply because they knew what had happened to them was unjust and decided that their own voices gave them the power to right an injustice. Looking back at how I allowed myself to be tormented by the game change interview process, I see some irony in the fact that my story will be published and game change will not, because of the Me Too voices who had the courage to speak up and say what Mark Halperin had done to them. Well beyond my small experience, there is something very powerful in the Me Too movement's outing of men who, through their work in media, politics, and art, had been the dominant storytellers of our time. It's given a turbocharged boost of inspiration to women to understand the power of their stories and to tell them. We have learned to stop searching for where we fit into history because we are writing our own story. Chapter 8, Undefeated. Even when you lose, refuse to be defeated. It's Saturday, September 10th, 2016. The Doral Arrowwood Hotel in Westchester County, New York. It was near the Clintons' home and was the hotel we used for debate prep meetings throughout the campaign. I come in late to debate prep. The room is silent when I walk in and stays silent for 4 full minutes. I count them. 4 minutes is a long time. Things aren't going well. I gather the topic is why our economic message isn't breaking through more. We move on to discuss the Trump campaign's stepped-up attacks against Hillary. It's been a few days since Steve Bannon's appointment as CEO of the Trump campaign and their declaration of a scorched-earth strategy to drive down enthusiasm for Hillary by relentlessly attacking her. I understand the Trump campaign also hopes its attacks will drive down the morale of our own campaign team, and in that moment, they are succeeding in doing so. That gets me mad. After all our campaign has survived, we can't let the Trump team deflate us like this. It's my nature to try to see a terrible situation in the best possible light. Most people would look at the Trump campaign's new team and strategy and be chilled. I choose to see a frustrated group who has been trying to tear Hillary Clinton down for the last 25 years and hasn't been able to do it. I am still not fully recovered from my own illness that landed me in the hospital. I speak anyway. I go off on a tear, an epic tear. I recount in detail all the attacks Hillary has had thrown at her in her adult life. This takes a while. I go on to what she has faced in this election. Emails, 11-hour Benghazi testimony, an FBI investigation, WikiLeaks, a grueling Democratic primary, 17 people, 15 Republican candidates, and 2 in the Democratic primary, attacking her every single day. Hillary Clinton was subjected to more attacks than any presidential candidate in our history. Those attacks would have killed a weaker candidate. No one but her could have survived all of this. Madam Secretary, I say, do not see all these attacks and get discouraged. Look at them and marvel at how frustrated these Republicans are that they can't take you down. Think about what a miracle it is that you are still standing. It is a fucking miracle, I conclude, my voice shaking. Silence in the room. She nods. And for the first time that day, I see her give a slight smile. I have processed and accepted a lot of what happened in this election. The one thing I haven't been able to accept is that her attackers finally succeeded in defeating her. I just don't believe that's true. Whether or not you are defeated is your choice. Defeated is when you fail to look your opponent in the face and call them out on their hate or lies. Defeated is when you cower when attacked. Defeated is when you give up the fight. Worse, defeated is when you give up hope. Hillary never cowered in the face of attacks or failed to call out hate. And after she lost, she refused to stop fighting for the